This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph J. Welsh for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Today is April 19, 2005. It's approximately 1:15 p.m. Central Standard Time, and I am in the archive interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Welsh is in Castroville, Texas. Joey, why don't we start with biographical information on yourself? Can you tell me when you were born, where you were born, and a little bit about your childhood?
Okay, I was born in South Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on December 18th, 1947. I basically only stayed there about 6-7 years, and then we made the great escape across the bridge to South Jersey when they started building the suburbs out there. So, my father worked for Gulf Oil Corporation for 42 years.
Wow.
Which was right over there in Philadelphia. He took time out to go to, he was in Second World War for 3 years and contracted TB, which was, fortunately he survived that, and but he did, you know, spend a couple of years over in fighting in the islands in the Navy. And then I grew up in a place called Somerdale, New Jersey, which is probably about, I guess, 20 miles from the bridge in Philly. And basically everybody was from Philadelphia anyway. And
Tell me about your dad. He was in the Navy in World War II.
Yeah.
Did he talk to you about what he did?
No, that was the thing. We didn't talk too much about it. I guess when I was a kid, you know, the only thing I can recall is that, you know, he was a CB, and then he was on the landing crest. He would drive the landing crest for the Marines. Okay. And he had been in Guadalcanal and places like that. And, you know, he would tell me about some of his training, but we never really, you know, got it, pursued it. And my mother and father divorced when I was 14. And then when I came back the first time, and, you know, everybody was all excited. And then they said, where are you going? I said, back to Vietnam, and they weren't very excited. I remember myself and my brother-in-law, who helped raise me because I was with him most of the time, and my father were, you know, we had a few drinks, and now he wanted to know about me, and then I wasn't ready to, you know, to talk about it. You know, I just didn't feel ready to talk about it at all. So we, you know, we got in, you know, almost got in a little scuffle there, you know, and I said, you know, you, when you told me, Dad, you had been back for years and years, you know, I said, you know, just give me some time and all that, you know. But he was in some wild stuff. They were, the Marines there, I know they were going on one island, a Marine ship one side, and the paratroopers were supposed to land on the other side and catch the Japanese in the middle. Well, they weren't real good at putting out paratroopers in them days, and they winded up landing in the middle.
Oh, boy.
And when he got there, I'll never forget this story because, you know, he told me again when I was going in, because that's why I went in to paratroopers, was that when they got there, they were in the water fighting hand-to-hand when, when they went in to pick them up, you know. So, but he, you know, he's seen a lot of action in the, probably more so than most naval guys, because he was on the boats, you know, taking them in and all. But you know, he did 2 or 3 years, and then went right back to work with Gulf, and then, you know, just stayed with them.
Tell me about your mother.
My mother, well, I was the baby of the family, so, you know, I was real close with my mother, and just like the rest of us, seemed like everybody. I grew up with mostly Italians.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, especially the youngest son is the spoiled one, you know. So we basically got away with murder. Well, it's not murder, but...
Yes, I understand. You know, how many brothers and sisters, Joey?
Well, I had my father had a brief marriage sometime, you know, before all this went down. With my mother, and then so I had a stepsister, and then I had an older sister, and then I was the youngest.
Okay, so there are three of you.
Yeah, right. Well, right. I mean, we were real close with the stepsister, my stepsister. They lived up in Bucks County, up in Pennsylvania. And me and my sister were about 6 years apart, though.
Okay.
And so, you know, but we became, you know, as basically she helped raise me after, I'd say, you know, before he even, my dad even got divorced, you know, we were pretty wild kids, you know. Well, we don't consider it now compared to now, but we had our little gang system. And as you grew older, you went farther away from the town, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was like a. The odd thing about it was when I moved to New Jersey, I'd never even seen a lawn.
Really?
Okay.
Wow.
And then I'm living in the last row of houses, and I had like a mile and a half, 2 mile track of woods, which I had never seen. I think that's where I started my military training, because we actually did. We had underground forts. We stole all the stuff off the. Most of the contractors that were building the houses still, and that was, of course, we were younger then. That was our first development. Then we got into the gangs or the older guys that would hang out there and drink and stuff like that. And then they moved up into the cars, you know. Well, first of all, you move up into the bus system, and you would see, you go down to other towns, to record hops and stuff like that. We're talking, you know, the early 60s, late 50s, and then getting fights. And, of course, we were going there for the girls, and of course, and it worked both ways. They would come to our place, too, you know.
Right.
And then, because I remember... five or six of us went up to Camden, New Jersey. I don't know if you've heard of Camden, but we went up to Camden, New Jersey one afternoon and went into a movie theater. And we walked in a bathroom, and before we knew it, there was about 15 or 20 guys on us, beating the hell out of us. And the only way out was to catch the next bus.
Right.
So we were pretty fast. And, you know, so we sort of got beaten out of that town. And when we get back, the older group laughed. Well, I guess you're not ready for Camden yet, huh? to them, that was, you know. But I played sports with all of us, with me every day, because we had a field in between my house and this other house. And
this is in Somerville?
In Somerdale.
Somerdale, okay.
Yeah, Somerdale.
Okay.
Two of them. Okay. This one is down in the Camden County area, which is Gloucester and Belmar and Somerdale, Stratford. Basically on the way to, I guess, over the Walt Whitman Bridge and down that way.
Right. Now, did your dad remarry?
Right, yes. He remarried some woman from the town. My dad was very charismatic. I mean, very well dressed for Frank Sinatra type guy, and she'd all that. We used to have block parties. At the neighborhood where they'd have bands in there all the time, and he was MC. He was very well dressed, in good shape. He was a boxer in the Navy. Always had a brand new car every couple of years and stuff like that. He came from a pretty rough family. My actual name is Walsh, W-A-L-S-H.
Okay.
My grandfather was Paddy Walsh.
Okay.
Who had 11 children, and the two youngest died. He had 10 boys and one girl. And they both died of lobster or tetanus. And then my father was born. He was the last born, and he was named after the child who had died. This is when they were all in Philadelphia, and he owned some haberdashers and things like that. You know, clothing stores.
Yes.
And basically, these were all fronts, apparently, because he had his hands in everything. He was a When he came over, he was a bare knuckle fighter from Ireland. And what happened was, when he died, my two or three oldest uncles got together and had our name changed to Welsh, so that we could sort of, you know, get, I guess, not only credit wise, but, you know, personnel-wise, I guess.
So, to make it easier for you all?
Or? Yeah. Because my grandfather had, was involved in a lot of things, that was going on that then in them days. My dad would tell me stories that, you know, they'd be walking down the street, and, of course, he would dress, everybody dressed up in them days, you know, and, three or four punks came up to him one day, and he was holding my, he said, I'll never forget it, because in one hand he was holding me, and then he just reached in and pulled out a 38, that's what my dad said, something like that, and said, get the hell out of here, and then, you know, off they went, and then they continued on their Sunday stroll, you know. So, and he was big enough to, with a name like Paddy,
Right.
Yeah. So, because of all the dealings he was involved in and stuff like that, they changed the name to Welsh.
Okay.
And, I didn't know many of my uncles. I never met my grandmother and grandfather were dead when I was born, on my father's side, and my grandfather was alive for a few years on my mother's side, which I vaguely remember. So I had no grandparents. I had the godmother, or what we call the godmother. My godmother, who basically was the historian, I was her favorite, of course, and whoever, not my Joey, you know. It's just like, it was the strong Irish family like that is just like an Italian family, but, the boys can do no wrong. And
right.
Especially if you're the young one. So, growing up, I started getting a lot of trouble, and also they winded up sending me up to Connecticut where my brother-in-law was when I was about 16.
What kind of trouble were you getting into?
Anything that we could find. In them days, like I said, we would get, it was mostly fights. Mostly going out and going to these record hops and, on the weekends and getting in fights and drinking. And, you know, we're talking, I probably started drinking when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. Not much.
Yeah.
You know, a pint of wine would knock the two of us out. But, I was just very rebellious and, class clown,
Tell me about school. What were you like in school?
Well, in school, when I in grammar school, the first I can't remember, very young, when I was very young, but well, I started off in an all boys Catholic school in South Philadelphia.
Okay.
And then I, when I crossed the bridge, you know, it was a melting pot, really, and I went to a public school, and that's when the Untouchables were on.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all in the gangster stuff. I mean, we were the gangsters, Warren Elliott and that.
Right.
You know?
Of course.
Yeah, and it's just that, you know, I was just very rebellious, you know. I passed all my grade, mm-hmm. you know, my academics. But, you know, I was always playing hooky and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Do you know, have you ever explored why you think you were so rebellious as a kid?
No, my mother let me get away with pretty lot, and then that's the way it was with most of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All she had to do to stop it was say, "I'll tell your dad," and, you know, "Well, okay, let's talk it over, Mom," you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. It was just in the same, in the, you know, like, in the next night, I'd be playing my heart out. For like 11 years, I played baseball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I played football in high school. I mean, we were all athletic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a streak that we all had. I don't know if it was coming from the city or what. And God knows what would happen if I was staying in the city, because, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, so much more involvement up there. But,
yeah. What do you remember about Philadelphia?
From when I was living there, when I was very young, I was only 7, you know. I just remember the row houses, you know, one house right next to each other, real small roads, and like I said, some action here and there, you know, going down that I can vaguely remember. I wasn't there really long enough for it to sink in. A lot of times I'd be put in the house, you know.
Right, right. You know. Were you a Phillies fan or following baseball, football there?
No, I was never really. For a few years when I was a Flyers fan,
mm-hmm.
when they were, you know, winning and stuff like that, but that was much, you know, that was years and years later, and
yeah.
That was basically where I was hanging out and the people I was hanging out with, you know, and they fought.
Mm-hmm.
The Broad Street Bullies, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and they won 3 years in a row, so, you know, sort of, I got a little hockey fever then, but as far as playing-wise, I mean, I played, you know, since I was, I guess, 8 or 9 years old, and I remember I played a couple years, about my second year in Little League, and I was pitching, and I, you know, you're still playing amongst your peers and your friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're just on a different team, and I hit a kid in the ear, and he went down pretty bad, and I felt pretty bad, and they took me up to Philly.
Yeah.
And my cousin was on the farm team for Philadelphia. And they sat me down with him. Joseph was his name. Big, big hulk of a man.
Yeah.
And he said, "Why the hell do you want to be a pitcher?" You know.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, you're a pitcher." He said, "No, you want to be the catcher. The catcher runs the whole team." And then, you know, he just talked to me about it, and that, you know, hey, this seems to come to happen and on. So, and I wasn't that, you know, big, you know. And so from that day on, I just got behind that plate and I never left.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Were you a good ball player?
Pardon me?
Were you a good ball player?
Yeah, I was an excellent ball player. I got MVP 2 or 3 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that anything I did, whether it was good or bad, I had to do it the best.
Right.
You know, I had a very, very, very bad temper and about that. And I had to adjust because, like when I played freshman football, I was just 106 pounds.
In high school?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 106 pounds and played every single game. Both offense and defense,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I had guys trying to run over me 220 pounds, you know, it's just, and where we grew up, it was in your heart,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was thin, you know, skinny kid, you know,
mm-hmm.
but then what happened was my mother and father got divorced, and then my brother-in-law came into the picture.
Yeah,
he was one of the toughest guys in the Tri-County area,
mm-hmm.
and he was a tall, skinny guy,
mm-hmm.
right? And there was times when I had guys chase me home, and we had one thing or another, but I had to go back out there, and then between him and my cousin, they started working with me. And it was just a matter of... the way I see it now, like when I did it with my son, that sooner or later he'll get tired of it.
Right.
And he'll stand up. And that's what happened. I mean, even your friends will, you know, will mess around with you and smack you around. And then just one day you pop them, and then you realize, you know, you pop them, and then you pop them again and pop them again, and then, you know. Then when I went up to, I was 15 when I went up to Connecticut, and I spent a year up there, and that's where I started my martial arts training.
Joey, let me ask you a couple questions. You said you had a bad temper as a kid. I mean, it sounded like you had some role models for that. I mean, you were raised in a tough way, you know, running around with this crowd and kind of having to defend yourself. I mean, do you want to talk about any of that and how that developed? I mean, did you feel like you had to defend yourself a lot out on the street, or did this come from your dad or Patty?
Well, no, my dad was real good, you know, disciplinarian in mm-hmm. the way of, he was strict.
Mm-hmm.
You sat down, you ate it all and left. But I got away with a lot more than because of my mother covering for me.
And you knew you could, I guess, after it happened.
Yeah, but I know that now. But all she had to do was say, "We'll tell your father," and this went for me and the other guy who were Italian guys, you know, that lived on my street. You know, we ceased to exist. You know, okay, it's okay, we're done,
mm-hmm.
Mom. We won't do this, we won't do that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
The temper, I don't know where it came from. My brother-in-law had a bad one. He was just a snap out too, but,
mm-hmm.
You know, mine had just, like I said, this guy he was my best friend really, but he always used to be pushing me around, and then one day he just pushed me off my bike, and I got up, and we stood up, and then I just whacked the shit out of him,
uh-huh.
and, you know, like, yeah, he's bleeding all over, and, you know, so he said, he started going home, he said, "I'm coming back, I'll meet you at your house," so, you know, I went home, and I was all freaked out and psyched up, and you know, he came up and he says, "What the hell did you hit me for?" I said, "Well, you've been punching on me for years, man."
Yeah.
He said, "Yeah, but I ain't never beat you up." I said, "Well, you can't beat me up." You know, and
right.
Remember that. And that was it, you know.
Yeah.
And then I realized, you know, and from my brother-in-law telling me the same thing, that, you know, it's better to go down, you know, fighting than running. You can't run. And he helped me a lot. And then when I moved into the, up in Connecticut, and I started taking the judo.
Mm-hmm. Why did you start that?
I started that because when I get up there, I was the, they used to call me the gangster. I was the only guy. Now, this is southeast Connecticut, New Milford.
Why did they call you that?
Well, I was the only guy in the place that wore black socks. I mean, they were all true farmers of America.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I dressed, you know, with a, you know, a nice shirt and pants and black socks and Corvin wingtips and all, you know.
Yeah.
Philly stuff, you know, like jerseys. That's the way we dress, you know. And, you know, I got tested a couple times and I did all right. Nobody, you know. And then finally they, you know, sort of kind of said, hey, man, you know, well, we're taking this judo thing. Why don't you come over there? And so I started taking the judo, and it was the old judo where they, you know, you're on a gym floor and they don't use any mats.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then that sort of expanded my relationships with a lot of people because we lived up in the trail and it's kind of mountainous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really didn't have any problems up there with anybody at all. And the girls kind of like, it was attractive to the girls because I was like, not the Fonzie, but I was just so different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I don't speak very well anyway because from where I come from, we speak fast,
mm-hmm.
and unless you really study,
right.
You know, we speak our own language.
Mm-hmm.
And I can recall my English teacher in sophomore year up there saying, let me see, how did he put it? And he spoke like five languages and all, you know.
Yeah.
And I was reading a passage, and I said something. There was three adults, and he said, Mr. Welsh, it's adult. And I said, Mr. So-and-so, it's adult. I'm from Philly. That's the way I speak,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just the way I was. I went right back at him. I'm like, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
I cannot change, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on a couple of times, but he never sent me down to the principal or nothing like that. I just told him, you know, hey, where I come from, it's got all of it's orange, it's a radiator, it's, you know, that's it.
Yeah, that's who I am.
And that's who I spoke, that's how I spoke to him,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
How old was your brother-in-law?
He was, I don't know, I guess he was 7 or 8 years older than me. So I was like in 15, and he was probably about 24.
Okay.
Okay, and he grew up on the streets of right next to Camden,
mm-hmm.
Which is worse than South Philly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he was, I didn't know at the time, but he was known, you know, for being, you know, a big time street fighter, and I didn't know any of this at the time, you know, because they just started going out. And then, as you know, after time went on, I got to move around a little bit with him, and I seen some of the guys he was hanging out with.
Mm-hmm.
And little did I know that, you know, I stayed with them for about a year. Made it through my freshman course,
mm-hmm.
and then they moved up there, and then my mother, I got put on probation for drinking.
Right, by the high school?
No, by the cops.
Okay.
Well, the reason they caught us is one guy was on crutches, so, you know,
they
knew us. They knew us all.
Right.
And my dad was a politician. He got into politics, and his position was in the transportation sort of thing, just town politics.
Right.
But he was very, he hired and fired the cops.
Right.
And so as I, you know, so basically we were getting away with, you know, we weren't doing anything really that bad,
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
Raising hell is what we were doing.
Now, your dad stayed in touch with you when you were up there in Connecticut?
Well, what happened was, of course, when he left,
mm-hmm.
all right, And you know, there's probably a couple cops that, you know, had it out for, because they called it Joey Walsh's gang.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They called it Joey Walsh's gang.
So you were at the top of the heap.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you like that?
Well, no, I really wasn't. It's just that we were all the same. It's just that I was the ringleader because, in their mind, you know, I guess because of my dad, that's what they thought I was getting away with a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happened was, so they knew who the different groups were throughout the town.
Right.
And it wasn't hard to find out who was on crutches. And so what happened was they came at, we were fighting amongst each other, which was very common. And the cops came, and we all ran. Now, of course, the guy in crutches got caught. Well, this is how, remember now, I just spent about 6 years in the woods. I snuck over to the cop shop and climbed up the back of the cop station and watched them as they interrogated the kids. They have one in one room, one in the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where kind of head I was in. Mm-hmm. I didn't go home.
I see what you're saying.
You see?
Yeah.
And
you're doing a little recon and
yeah. I was into that, you know.
Yeah.
I watched this, I can get away with this. And then I went home, and then of course they came and got me, and I said, no, what you talking about? And then I knew that they had us because the guy in crutches,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then the guy that I'd beaten up before had both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that, they can just take out the list and just go right down the list.
Right.
Know? So they gave us 3 months probation, you know. We were only like 14, 13, 14,
mm-hmm.
you know, had to be in at 9 o'clock, had to go to church every Sunday, get the priest signed your note, and then go down to the chief police and just show it to him and all.
Were you Catholic?
No, when I crossed the border, I was in an all Catholic school. My dad
right.
said, you know, your mom and I don't pursue any religious beliefs in the way of going to church. You know that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and I'm not going to push it on you. He said, you know, you was in Catholic school, and now you're in public school, and you go where you want to go. So I used to go to church with my buddies. I'd go to Catholic church, I'd go to Presbyterian, mm-hmm. wherever, you know, and, you know, so I was baptized Catholic, but that was it, you know.
Did you feel like you had a personal need to do that, or did you want to just hang out with your buds?
Well, I wanted to see, you know, and there's a certain type of, there is kind of, when you're young, you know, there's I guess it's a respect, but there's also a fear of, you know, what's going on here.
Yeah.
But being from especially when you go through an all-boys Catholic school your first year, you know, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And, like now, I feel very comfortable in a church, any church. Okay, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I've come to peace with myself, and I understand what I feel, you know, but I do not attend church, you know. But that's how I did it. I went up, I would go with them. Now, I had to go to church for 3 months, and I did go to Catholic.
Okay.
You know, and it got to be pretty cool because I think that helped us because we got to meet with the priest. You know, God, we got to meet with the priest, you know. At first couple of times it was a little, but, you know, he was cool, you know.
Yeah.
After a while you realize that it's a man with dressed up, you know, and he'd say, how you guys being good and all that kind of stuff, rah, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on an informal basis and not, mm-hmm. he wasn't some, you know, untouchable figure.
Right. He was kind of talking to you.
He was a human being, and he sat down there, and he basically had our will being in within him. That's what he wanted.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was cool. We did it for 3 months, but, you know, I didn't continue. However, on occasion, I would go, like, to midnight mass with them on Easter and all. So it kind of relaxed me in the religious field where I didn't feel that I needed to go there. And I found out later in Vietnam that I was right. I didn't need to go there. Mm-hmm. I had my own God with me. Mm-hmm. And my concept of God then was that if there's a God that is everywhere, then God has to be energy.
Okay.
You know, that's mm-hmm. sort of my, you know, come to terms. If they say there is such a thing that there's this thing or spirit, then the only thing that's everywhere and everything contains it is energy, this form of energy, you know.
It's a very, very literal translation, basically. If God is possible being everywhere, then he has to be this. This is what makes sense to me.
Yeah. And whether there's a heaven and hell, who knows? I just know they're burning me because I ain't going that cold ground. Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me about when you finished your freshman year up in Connecticut and you moved.
No, I finished. Well, here's what happened. Little did I know that all this took place, but I knew that my mother and father got divorced, and then my father married. I won't even use the word stepmother, but that's what she was. Now, she was teaching in Gloucester, which was right next to Belmore, where my brother-in-law grew up. And Gloucester was right next to Camden. And they were living in a one-bedroom apartment. Well, I was expecting to be, when they picked me up, which was, in June, at the end of because my brother-in-law's sister had to leave early, so I stayed with my friend up there in Connecticut to finish my last couple months. When they picked me up, they took me to their one-bedroom apartment, and they had her 3 kids in there.
Right.
And who were very small, and there was some kind of wrongdoing in the way of she had them for visitation rights and wouldn't give them back. And she had all this planned anyway. And of course I was, what do they call it? Juvenile delinquent,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, I started going to school there now that was a tough school. But my brother-in-law, having the reputation that he had, knew all the guys whose nephews and younger brothers and cousins and all went there.
Mm-hmm.
So my ticket in was a lot easier than most, okay?
Yeah.
'Cause I remember going to school the first day, I made it down to the corner, and I could walk. It was right around behind the apartments, and I can remember to this day, as soon as I came up to the corner, there was a few girls there, and really pretty girls. Oh, hello, who are you? Geez, I'm gonna like this, you know. And then when I got into the hallways, especially some pretty stout dudes, and I said, well, here we go, and the guy comes up and he says, you Joey Wells? I said, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Getting ready to drop my books and scrap, and he said, he put his hand out. He says, well, I'm Johnny Furry's. Okay. You're Dusty Gillis. And it was like, you're Dusty Gillis's, brother-in-law,
Mm-hmm.
And I like, yeah. He says, yeah, man, we know Dusty, man. He's a badass. Come on over here. I'll meet you. So then one thing led to another. I was in. I was in. And then I had missed football because of the tryouts being, before school started, and I got there late. And a couple of them played Inner City, and they said, you play ball? I said, hell yeah. And they said, well, come on out with Inner City. And, I talk about Inner City, you know. And so we played, you know, the surrounding area, which was, they had parts of Canaan, but the places we played Blackwood and all these little towns. And we'd get up there on a bus, and they'd drive us to a field on a weekend, and we'd play and, mm-hmm. you know, get on the bus for halftime, hang out, and then come home.
What was your position, Joey?
I was usually a wide receiver, and then, believe it or not, I'd be a linebacker. But I was like the roving linebacker.
Yeah.
Because I was fast.
And you would take heads off.
Yeah, no. What I would do is, I would just find out where they were going, and you know, just somehow they. Because I remember the first time the coach noticed me was when one of our top runners tried to run through me. Now, he ran through me and over me, but he never went any further because I was wrapped around him, arms and legs, and this was when I was a freshman. He said, "Who the hell is that under there?" And Dobbins got up and said, "Welsh, of course." And he said, "Damn." You know, because this guy was, you know, a black guy. You know, we had a lot of blacks in when I was a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way, you know, once again being brought up playing field football. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Tell me about the mixture of races there. Were there any difficulties, any problems? This is the early...
No, we, in fact, it was kind of weird because where we lived, because we were a growing community, we had to be, my sister had to be shipped or bused several communities down. Okay, so mm-hmm. she went to a rah-rah school we called Haddon Heights, which was up near Haddonfield and all that, you know, upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got around going to high school, they had built a high school for our three little towns, which mm-hmm. was Summerdale, Stratford, and Magnolia.
Mm-hmm.
And Summerdale was, I guess you could say, the street kids, athletic, but street kids. The Stratford was the, they were, I guess, more academic, athletic and academic, but not as, you know, street. And then Magnolia had a lot of blacks,
mm-hmm.
okay, which we never really interacted until we got in high school. And then when we went the first year they went in high school, of course, they only went up to junior. They let the seniors graduate from where they were.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I came in the first year as a freshman. Mm-hmm. I was in 4 years. And that was our second year, and I think we went to state finals in football.
Okay.
Because you mix them three together, your blacks, your white street, and then your white athletic mm-hmm. Jocks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had, you know, we definitely had a hell of an athletic program. And I used to go out and hang out with the black guys. I used to go down to the house and eat dinner with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way it was mm-hmm. because it was small. And now we would fight a white guy as fast as we would fight a black guy and in school.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you came to our school or we went to another school, it was school against school. We didn't care what you was.
Right.
And we did fight a lot on basketball game, even if we won,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
It was always a fight,
yeah.
You know, constantly.
Sounds like sports played a really big role in your childhood.
Oh, yeah. And then, I was always playing baseball. And then what happened was, when I was in Connecticut, they didn't have a football team. So I waited. I went out. I did the judo all winter. And I hurt my arm, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. And I went out for baseball, and after a couple weeks, they had, you know, I was a sophomore. I was playing, I was being looked at for the varsity position. But because I could, from on my knee, I could hit second base in a heartbeat. But there was something wrong with my arm, and from it constantly using it, I was favoring it. So that's, I missed going, making varsity, and I played JV. In fact, I had to sit out for a while, and they never, and then they, I don't know, I think it was now, I think it was tendonitis, but they couldn't tell me what it was because I couldn't straighten out. What happened was the guy threw me, and, you know, instead of, you know, letting me go, he driving me into the mat, he held on to it, and it I think it's tore some tendons.
Right.
And the throwing, at first, man, I was like, you know, dazzling everybody, and then it just, you know, was hurt too bad, and, you know, it just couldn't straighten it all out and all that kind of stuff. And I went, I remember going to the doctors, but nothing ever materialized of it. Finally just went away on its own, you know. But yeah, I played ball up there, and then, like I said, by the time I got back to Gloucester, they had started football. So I played inner city football, which was great because basically we went up against Fairview, which was undefeated, all blacks, and we went to their town, their little field, and he said, let's kick some ass. And I don't know if anybody ever scored or anything, because all we did, every time they hiked the ball, we just start fighting and knocking them over. And, well, at halftime, you go into the buses. Well, they got in the bus and they left.
Oh, really?
They forfeited.
Jeez.
Oh, this was like unknown. I mean, this was, they had never lost.
Right.
Okay. But they, on their own home field, I mean, there, I know there was a lot of arguing going on between the adults and coaches and all, but we didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, we just really didn't give a shit. You know, we were going to win one way or another, and we hadn't lost, and I don't think they had lost, and so, you know, we just intimidate them. That was our coach's thing, intimidate. Don't be intimidated. You go there and be intimidated. They think you're scared of them or anything like that. So, you know, as soon as they'd hike it, somebody knee somebody, somebody kick somebody. I mean, these guys had never been treated like that. You know, everybody was like, you know, so. Yeah, it got around that, you know, we were pretty damn good at something because they chased them off their own field. Because the coach came back in, and he kind of had a smirk on his face, and we said, what's going on? He said, they forfeit. I don't even think we scored. I don't know if anybody scored, but, you know. So that was a big bonding of the crowd that I hung with, and and we were constantly out there, you know, looking for girls and, you know, getting in trouble. It was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of fighting. I mean, you had to fight.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. You had to fight. Unless it was your best friend, you might want to try to talk them out of it, especially, you know, if you're drinking or something, you know. But besides that, you know, that's the way it was. And I had to rely on speed and stealth. And that's where I picked it up in the martial arts. That, you know, these guys could run right over me. They could pick me up and slip me all over. But if I did this and I did that. And I had this small guy, stocky, who was in the military. And he picked that up on me right away, that you know, whoever told you to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I said, it made sense to me, you know. You know, he said, well, he came over here and he talked to me. He said, you know what you did? I said, what? He said, well, when he went to throw you, you threw your body and reversed it, and you became in front of him. And so he was already going that way, and so it's called a reverse flip, and you're not supposed to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but it worked, you know.
Right.
You know, so because of the speed, that's what I relied on.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And then also, if I was outnumbered, I could run fast.
Joey, tell me why, when you mentioned your mother-in-law, you said, you know, kind of so-called mother-in-law. Why was that? Your dad's new.
No, I'll cut right to the chase from there.
Okay.
She was a teacher in the elementary school in Gloucester.
Uh-huh.
And she, my father and her brought a house in Barrington. And the Barrington was, if you lived there, you had to go to the rah-rah school where my sister originated. And I'd have got killed if I went there, being from where I was from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we moved out there, and she used to drop me off in the morning. It was no problem for her because she went right by the high school to get the elementary.
Mm-hmm.
And she picked me up in the afternoon. Well, then, I guess 6 months into school or whatever, she said, my dad said, look, somebody called and said that you're, you know, living here and, we're gonna have to pay tuition if you stay there. And I knew that was bullshit. She was tired of taking me. She didn't want to be tied down. She wanted me, you know, she was just tired of it. And I loved it. I mean, I was going to school every day. I was passing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was in my beginning of my junior year. And, you know, I said, well, I'm not going to Haddon Heights. You know, I said, Dad, they'll kill me over there. I had to be in Sterling. And that's where I was, you know, my first year in Connecticut. And then coming out of Gloucester, I said, I wouldn't go to Haddon Heights, no way.
And so, what'd your dad say?
Well, there wasn't much he could say, because when I said no, I meant no. And I said, you know, I'm going to try to move back in with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved back in with my mother. And then...
Where was she?
She was still at the original house from where I grew up.
Okay.
And my brother-in-law and sister were living there at the time, too. But then when, and see, even though I was running with a pretty bad crowd, I mean, I went to school and I was playing sports and I was passing and everything. But then when I got back to Summerdale,
mm-hmm.
I went back with the old crowd that I had
right.
grown up with.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't maybe 3 months, and I was getting in trouble again. And then we got in this big fight after a basketball game, and they caught some of us, and I got suspended for a couple weeks. And... So then my mother went away on vacation, I remember that, and so I stole her car, and I went to Connecticut where I used to live, and I did a two-week route all over and winded up back at Gloucester, and just called up and told my dad, knowing my mother would never sign, I said, I ain't coming back unless you let me quit school.
Right.
I said, because, you know, I ain't going to stay in at school because... I'm a marked man, you know.
Yeah, right.
So he said, okay, well, my brother-in-law caught me. And of course, I went down to pick up my paycheck, and my brother-in-law caught me on it. And he whacked the shit out of me a little bit, and get in the goddamn car, he's driving your mother crazy and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother wasn't there to put up a fight, but so they let me quit school. So I quit in March or April of my junior year, and I was passing.
Okay.
You know, I just quit, and then this whole time, I never talked to my stepmother. She was all her kid this, her kid that, her kid this, her kid that.
Right.
Really pulled my father, who was very close to me and his daughters, really pulled them away. And I'm going to finish this to get it over with.
Okay.
Because years later, after I had come and gone, staying all over and things like that, after I get out of the service and everything like that, I'd stay with him once in a while, and I was sort of jumping around because I was semi-quasi-married. Then he got diagnosed with cancer liver, and before that we got real close.
Okay.
Before that we got real close because I wasn't working, and I would drive him around everywhere, and where we were playing, my stepsister's husband was a cop in Philadelphia who got wounded in a bus, and he became a detective, and he worked up at Bucks County DA office.
Mm-hmm.
So he hooked us up with a lawyer. My dad was pretty good. He was well off. He had invested in the stocks and all that stuff from Gulf Oil Corporation since it began. He had a beautiful house that he had redone. He had an outdoor heated pool. He had he just invested his money very wisely. And, and all she would tell me is when I go, you'd get my car. That's all I cared about. I didn't care about no money. But anyway, then he started bringing over insurance policies to my sister, saying that, in case anything happens, I want you to sign, get this filled. Well, my sister said, we ain't signing shit. You sign it over to us. So finally, we were having these meetings with the divorce lawyer and talking about a divorce, and the lawyer was saying, hey, with what you got right now, you're going to get half of it, but at least you're going to get, get, but I said to him, why do you stay? And he said, well, I'm content, and she takes good care of the house and all that. Well, then he gets sick, and I was working. I was coming out of my rebellion. Well, that's another story about when I come back from Vietnam. But this was the 72, 73. I got into the EMT paramedic program. And that's because I couldn't hold a job, and that just grabbed me. I mean, that's what I needed,
Yeah.
Ring the siren, I'll go, And so I became pretty obsessed with that, and I got really involved in it, and I was working in the ER, and I was working in Camden as a paramedic volunteer, and then volunteer at the local level. And our doctor, who I grew up with, our hometown doctor, was the EMS coordinator up there and all. And so, at the time, my father started getting jaundice and stuff, and they put him in. So then, the doc, I was on call, and he called me over, and I said, what's the deal? And he said, well, I'm not supposed to tell you anything, but I know your dad has already requested you to come up there. And he said, but, he's got cirrhosis, cancer, liver, and I said, how much time? He said, I'd give him 4 months.
Okay.
So, it's just like that fast. And I said, okay, so I grew up, and then my dad tells me that, I don't want you to tell anybody, I want to go home and all that. And I said, he says, because I know you know what's going on. And I said, well, yeah, whatever you want, Dad, I said, take you home. So we took him home, and of course, it just hit so fast that, this was, October, November, December, January, February. It was about November, because he died on Valentine's Day, so it wasn't like within a month. He was morphed out. He was had so much morphine in him and all, and then my wife at that time, you know, we'd go over and visit and stuff like that.
Joey, how hard was this for you?
Well, being in the business and seeing it so much and then seeing death so much, it was hard for me in one way of losing him, but I knew that what he was going through because of being in the business, and that, you know, the sooner the better because of his condition. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, the suffering that, you know, he's gone through because of just, you know, studying and, you know, working around it and all. But I was so glad that we had come to terms and we were really, really close when, you know what I mean?
Yes.
That's, so I felt settled in my mind that, you know, that one little incident that we had when I came back from Vietnam, that was long past. We were very close, and what he wanted, that was what he wanted. He wanted to stay with her fine, you know,
mm-hmm.
and after all these meetings, he winded up staying with her. So then one night I went over and I said, I want to stay tonight.
Yeah.
And I could just feel, you know, and she said, no, you'll keep him awake. I'll keep him awake. He didn't know what was going on. He was so morphined up and could hardly move, was, you know. And my wife was there. She came back and said, you know, Dot was her name, thinks it would be better if you leave or he won't get rest. And I said, I'm telling you, Judy, I got to stay. And she
mm-hmm.
said, well, we're close, you'll call if anything happens.
Mm-hmm.
We left about 11, 3 o'clock, I get a call, she's in convulsions. I said, call the paramedics, and I beat them there, and then I jumped in the truck with them, and basically there was nothing they could do or he wanted done, you know, so we took him to the hospital where I worked out of, and
mm-hmm.
That was, by then it was around dawn, and there was, everybody come up, you know, the family came from Philly, from all over, that could get there, and what was weird was, and he looked terrible, but of course they hadn't seen him,
yeah.
You know, I had been seeing him, so it was, what was funny was there was so many people in and out and within the family, but his real family at that time, being in Way of Children, was myself and my sister and my stepsister and her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I laid down next to him and I said, Dad, you got to let it go. You just got to let it go. It's okay. And he let it go.
Right there.
Right there, right then. 10 o'clock. It was right 10 o'clock on the phone. And it was only us. And every 5 minutes, somebody else was in. But, you know, I said, we're all here for you. And I said, who is here? And all. And I just said, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Just let go. And he stopped breathing. And, you know, I started crying. And all. I was laying on it with him. But
mm-hmm.
what got me was, she wasn't there, the bitch. You know, nobody was there.
Yeah.
It was just his children and his godchild.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And that's when it hit me pretty hard.
Right.
You know. But I was okay. I, you know, I handled everything, and we were okay. Well, my stepsister was a wheeler dealer, and you know, we had a nice ceremony, which we made it and stuff like that, and I got up and said some things, and you know, everything went nice, and then we went over the house, and she gave Jeannie this, and gave me this, and gave me that, But when we came back to the house, to the family,
mm-hmm.
the godmother was sitting there, my Aunt May.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "What did you get, Joey?" And I showed her. And she said, "Where is his diamond rings?" And I said, "I don't know, Aunt May." And boy, she went off. That bitch, that goddamn bitch, I'm telling you, she's ripping them off. Mm. It's tradition in this family that all the, you know,
mm-hmm.
all the jewelries and clothes that fit or anything must be passed from father to son.
Right.
And when she gave me his turquoise, it was real Indian turquoise and all that. When she seen that, and then that's what my stepsister said, "This bitch, something's going on." And of course, we couldn't do anything till the 30th day when it became public. My stepsister was there, and she said, "We got to have a meeting." We went to a family meeting, and 7 days, we don't know what was on before that, 7 days prior to him dying, which is around 7 February, we had about a 6 or 8 inch blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
He supposedly got up out of the bed, got in the car, drove about 20 miles, and went up these stairs and went into a lawyer's office and changed his entire will to read that everything will go to his wife, and if she doesn't survive, everything will go to her children. Not a word was mentioned about his kids. So she ripped him off on his deathbed. What happened was, the way we figured it out,
mm-hmm.
is she might have been running around with the lawyer, but the lawyer came to the house and brought his secretary,
mm-hmm.
okay? And, of course, remember, I had my brother-in-law was a detective, mm-hmm. and we had the lawyer right behind him. And, you know, here, sign this, sign this, sign that. And I said, "Man, he's too morphined out. He could not make sense of anything
mm-hmm.
5, 6, 7 days before that."
Right.
"And you all know it." And the lawyer said, "You're right, Joey. You're absolutely right. Now you want to go to court." And I said, "You're damn right I want to take her ass to court." I said, "Look, I don't care nothing about the diamond rings. I wanted the car, you know?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "But it's the principle that she ripped my father off on her deathbed, and if I get a hold of her, I'll kill her." Well, that's all they had to hear. Okay.
Okay,
let's hold it up now. Hold it up. So come to find out was all they could do was have her freeze her assets.
Okay.
In other words, and he was worth well over $250,000. And she couldn't sell anything.
Mm-hmm.
She still had everything. She could use everything. And she could wait us out. And that's what the lawyer finally came down to. "Joey, you don't have the money. You have to bring all them doctors in, and them doctors are going to, some of them are going to say, well, it's possible," and that's all they have to do is say, "It's possible,"
right,
"that he did leave." She's going to lie. She's going to lie and stick with her lie, because she is a lying bitch,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyer is damn sure going to lie. He ain't going to say that he, you know, changed stories. So, you know, and... So, you know, it was just nothing we could do. And I said, "There's something we can do." And I left the house, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I took a ride and I cooled down. Because,
mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to do to a woman, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, from that time on, it was a couple of weeks later, my brother-in-law seen her. Now, he sort of took it in stride, like, you know, screw her, you know, it ain't nothing to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Oh, how you doing?" And he said, "Oh, fine." He said, "Oh, by the way, Mark, her son, he brought me a pistol." she made sure he knew that, you know.
Right.
Like a pistol was going to stop me, you know. But, yeah, I have a pistol now. He showed me, took me out to shoot it and all, so I feel a lot safer now and all. But he came home and told me that right away. I said, I'll take that pistol and shove it up her son's ass and blow his gut, you know. But I was quite bitter at that. Not because of the money. And that's God's honest truth. I didn't want a penny. I wanted the car. That's what my dad said that he would give me. It was a Chrysler Cordoba at the time. But we couldn't fight it. You know, we froze it for a while, and then after a while, we just had to let it go.
Right.
And, you know, so she was the step bitch, you know, and, you know, what goes around comes around, though. She died several years later. And now I was.
Well, I expected there was a story behind that when you said that about her earlier.
Yeah, she made me get out of school because she was tired of taking me back and forth. That was the bottom line.
Yeah.
Okay, which I blame on her for me. She put me back in with my old street gang. And that just sent me to shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then, you know, she rips my dad off on his deathbed. And at that time, my dad and I were closest we ever were. You know, for the past year before that, we were so close.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what she was doing. And we knew that she... That's why we got the my brother-in-law and another lawyer in it, because she was shrewd,
mm-hmm.
very, very shrewd. She was, you know, educated and stuff like that. And,
mm-hmm.
and my father kind of got off on that since he had only went to eighth grade. And,
mm-hmm.
But he was very, very smart and investment-wise and everything like that. But that, you know... you know, I'd spit on her grave in a heartbeat, you know, because you just don't do that,
mm-hmm.
you know. It had nothing to do with the diamond rings or the money, if anything, the car. But to my dad, it made my dad look to anyone, an outsider, that he didn't even care about us.
Right.
But we knew that it was not him.
Right, of course.
We never, ever held it against him, and that's why we knew it was a scam.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. So. Joey, why don't we take a break? This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Welsh. Today is May 10th, 2005. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, so on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Joey, you're in Castroville, Texas again. Let's pick up where we left off. You had basically talked about your family. You had gotten to the point where you had dropped out of high school, and I was wondering if you could kind of tell me how you felt after that and where you saw yourself going, and I think you had a pretty clear direction.
Well, you know, it was quite kind of a foolish move. It's just that I had been moved around in 3 years, like to four high schools.
Right.
And, you know, if I would have just stayed where I was very happy. I was passing and I quit in March my junior year.
Right.
Anyway, the following year, I turned 18, and, at that time, I knew the draft was going to be coming up, so I started researching, you know, the Marines and Army and all that. And, you know, ever since Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
I've just always been stuck on that Green Beret. You know,
yeah.
Ever since that first one I seen. So I enlisted in the Army with a guarantee to go to Airborne School for 3 years, and February 25th, 1966.
Tell me why the Army?
Because I have that Green Beret.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
That was it. That was the deciding factor.
Yeah, yeah. I had never seen one before, and when he was assassinated, I was home from school that day, I remember, and I turned on the TV, and it's 12:30, and you know they just announced it. And you know, as much as a street punk as I was, that really got to me because I don't know, everybody liked Kennedy. I mean, yeah. You know, he was just that kind of guy. And then when they had the funeral, and I seen him green berets, and then of course you know he is the one who went down there, and that's why it's named after him. He gave that beret to a presidential order.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no one can change that. Like the black beret was taken from the Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, that's where my final job was, at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So, and then I get into basic training, and, you know, we're almost completed, and, you know, I guess it's probably more drafted than enlisted, and they said, okay, anybody who wants to volunteer for jump school, raise your hand, you know?
Right.
So I'm going like, oh, you know, mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's how bad they need him. So if you passed the PT test,
mm-hmm.
Then you went to jump school. So, because I didn't know that. But it didn't bother me. I knew I was guaranteed. Little did I know that, you know, these two-year guys were, they were smart, too, because that's an extra 3 or 4 weeks here.
Mm-hmm.
And then a 30-day leave, and then they get to Vietnam. They might have around 18, 19 months. Well, when you was in Vietnam, and they got down to the enlisted or drafted,
mm-hmm.
If you was, say you had 7 months left, they'd let you extend for a cushy job. I should say cushy, but usually a safe job.
Right.
Because 30 days left, they don't want you in anything anyway. But a lot of the drafted guys would spend 11, 12 months online, and then they'd extend for a month or two, and once you had 179 days or less, they'd let you leave Vietnam and go right to the States and get out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
ETS.
Mm-hmm.
Estimated time of separation. Except for me. Mine was an entirely different situation.
Yeah.
When I graduated jump school, I requested Vietnam or the 101st. They gave me the 82nd. Well, that all happened in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, that's when you finish jumping. The next day, it was only about 155. They said, you've all been levied. And I said, what the hell's a levy, you know? They said, you're all leaving for Europe tomorrow, no leave.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed paratroopers, so fortunately, I feel now, because if I would have went to Vietnam then, you know, I wouldn't have known what I knew when I finally did go.
Right.
So I winded up the next day on a plane to Germany along the whole entire class.
Wow.
It saved a lot of people's lives,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I stayed over there, and I was with the 509th Airborne Infantry Mechanized, which was, trained and trained and trained and trained. And that, I had to be there 90 days before I could request, and I did. I requested to leave to go to Vietnam. But that 7, 8 months that I spent there, I learned so much and became so much more acquainted with the military. And in fact, when I signed out, 2 days before I got ready to sign out, the first sergeant called me in, and I'd only been in 11 months. And he said, well, I don't really have to do this, but since you got to wear greens, put this on there. And he threw me corporal stripes. I made E4 in 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how much I soldiered, you know. It was a very, very strict, training, and the training was great because you had Korea and Vietnam veterans training.
Mm-hmm.
So I got really, even though it was cold weather, that has no bearing on it, you know, the idea of just getting more familiar and being in the Army, I felt a lot more comfortable when I went to Vietnam.
Sure. Hey, Joey, let's go back and talk about your basic training.
Well, basic training was, it was brutal, you know, I mean.
You're at Fort Dix, right?
Yeah. I got stuck. Well, that's one thing about enlisting. When you get airborne, you sort of get tossed into the ringer for anything else. But I went through the basic training. It was February 25th. I went there February, March, and it was, we had, you know, the rottenest guy you could ever want, you know, very abusive, very hard. I was athletic, so, you know, the PT, you know, I sucked it up. I loved it. And basically, that's what I really needed. I needed somebody to grab me by the back of the neck and, you know, give me some direction.
When you say brutal, what are you talking about? Give me an example.
Well, I was pretty good at running, so they put me in the rear. In other words, here's what they do. We had a march. Anything less than 5 miles, you had a march to. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you had to take trucks to be there on time.
Mm-hmm.
So, we would rotate platoons. 1, 2, 3, 4. Then next day, 2, 3, 4, 1, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But we always started last. And we were expected to wind up first. And what he would do is the rest of the company move out, and he'd say, low crawl position, move. And, you'd have your pack on and your M14. And he'd walk backwards until somebody could touch his boot. And then we'd get up and start double timing to catch up with the back of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we were pretty dumb at first. You know, we'd all go in a straight line. Well, then we started throwing to, okay, you know, let's do end sweeps, you know. You've got to surround this guy quick and get, you know, to touch his boot.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to be crawling all the way across the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get up and we get in formation. Now, I was what they call a rear road guard with the vest and all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd run up ahead and it'd stop traffic and then have to catch up. And nobody better fall out behind me. Or I'd pay.
Mm-hmm.
So, as soon as we were close to the woods, as soon as we hit the woods, which was all sand, then he would just take off, and I don't even know how the other drills put up with it, but we would take a column of twos on each side, and we would go and get past them. I mean, this would all take a couple miles,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we would have to be in the front, all right?
Right.
And, I've had guys fall back, and I'd just be pushing with my rifle, pushing. I remember one day I was pushing this guy, and I'm just saying, you know, I'm trying to convince him, come on, man, come on, you know, you can't fall out. And he just said, well, let's move out. And the guy sort of fell off on a side trail, and I seen him grab his weapon and, you know, just start beating him with the butt of the weapon, kicking him in the butt and stuff. Well, I tell you what, when we get off from Fort Dix, I'll never forget this. We get off and they had to paint it yellow. You see this in the movies and you don't think it happened. They had the painted yellow feet that you stood in, you know, and, you are in a reception station, so you're still in civilian clothes and all, and they'll walk along and they'll pick the biggest guy out, and they hit this guy dead square in the chest, man, and he liked to fall down, and said, well, I said attention, that means don't move. Well, I'll tell you what, boy, you froze, you didn't move. And then they put these pile caps on, you know, the ones with the ear flaps,
and
you had to pull them down, and you had to wear an overcoat to cover yourself up, and they called you pussy, because you were still had long hair, and it wasn't long hair, but, you know, you had still, you, this was your reception station, where you was going to get, take your test and get your uniform. And until you got your uniform, geez, because you did, you ran around in this overcoat with this pile cap pulled down around your head.
Mm.
Then you got your uniform, and then by around that time, you know, they assigned you to your unit. And then when you got your unit, you know, they'd stop, and, you know, everybody all grab your bag, and then you double time up with your bags, and... so there's double time everywhere, and we would be on the third floor, and of course, when they blew the whistle, we had to be the first in formation, or we do it again.
That's tough.
And we do it again, and we do it again,
mm-hmm.
and we do it again. And then, he would, you know, it helped me as a drill sergeant, because I learned that, you know, you don't have to, if you yell all the time, it's not going to be effective when you do yell.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, but it was constant, and it was driving guys crazy. I mean, you know, and guys would be screaming at night and all, and, you know. And then they would put the pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you better get him right.
Mm-hmm.
So I know one night they came in, and I was going to try to stop them, but there was about seven of them. And this one guy that kept falling out, you know, they threw a blanket over him, and they beat the shit out of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, blanket party, you know, you're screwing us all up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where I felt I could beat the shit out of any one of them, but let's not interfere with the system, you know?
Yeah.
And if you didn't take a shower, that was the rough one. If somebody felt that you wasn't taking a shower, they'd take scrubbing brushes to you.
Now, why was that a big deal to take a shower?
Well,
besides the stench, but
well, yeah, it was just for personal hygiene, and guys like, you know, if you live, we had 8-man rooms. They were a brand new barracks, you know. And if a guy was a slob, you know, that you don't. Well, I would tell him the same thing. Hey, man, you stink, man. You know, when you come home, when you get a chance to take a shower, you want to take a shower. It's personal hygiene, right? And you know, some guys weren't. And they would only last 1 or 2 days, and then that night they throw them in there and they take them, you know, them big wooden scrubbing brushes, and they scrub his ass down, and
mm-hmm.
from then on he'd take a shower.
Mm-hmm.
Then once we, you know, we would get to the rifle range, and then we would, or any range we were doing, you know, we did everything, and then on the way back it would be the same thing. We would wait, they would take off, but it didn't take long.
Yeah.
We learned real quick. When, as soon as he said, low call position move, it was like a swarm of army of ants. He couldn't take 3 steps and somebody touched his boot.
Wow.
You know, and
yeah.
then we'd be up. And then we'd be on the run. And that went on and on and on. And, you know, I know a couple guys left, you know, babbling. I never seen them again. And then, but he really was competitive. So and he hadn't been. And I'm trying to remember. I don't believe. I just still got the book. I don't believe any one of the drill sergeants had been to Vietnam. Maybe one. You know.
Yeah.
Of course, because you know you get to know what to look for.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And. It was hard, really, really hard. I mean, okay, you know, the barracks aren't clean.
Mm-hmm.
Take all the furniture from the third floor, it's on the Sunday,
mm-hmm.
outside, and then clean the barracks, and then take it back up.
Wow. You know? Yeah, just constant stuff like
yeah.
that.
And then, now they got you built up to where, you know, and then we went into the hand Google sticks and all, and, you know, we were just mauling everybody, the other platoons, and we were just, boy, you get a chance to hit somebody, man. You know, that was it. And by this time, I had made squad leader.
Now, let me stop you. Why were you guys so good at that? Is it just because
of course, we had the chance to strike back at something, somebody, you know. Uh-huh. And you was just so pent up with, and we were. I was in tremendous shape. I mean, you know, I mean, from the running and everything like that, I maxed the PT test every time, and that's when we had to do the five events and all that. And plus, you know, I knew I had to take the test to get into jump school.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just finishing up. We had about a week left, and that was just final testing. And they let us, it wasn't even that, it was a few days. They let us have a couple beers apiece and some pizza or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. I mean, that's all we had the whole time. And, of course, the guys who didn't drink, we snuck that off. And the next day, now, when you leave a formation, yeah, and they might have a pistol grip, a pistol belt with a poncho on the back,
mm-hmm.
you know, in case it rains and a canteen of water. Or they might have a full pack. Mm-hmm. Whatever, you always leave an equipment guard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were going to chow, and I was a squad leader, and so I wasn't running. I was sort of, I was kind of hungover.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, just acting like, all right, keep moving, keep moving. And what I did was I stepped across the left rear of one of the ponchos. I didn't touch it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy, you know, he's in the same situation. He comes to pull arms and starts screaming at me, rah, 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 rah. You know, and I said, oh, fuck you, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I went up to him, and then he went to rifle butt me, you know. I mm-hmm. said, I didn't, you know, I was trying to tell him, like, I didn't step in your damn shit, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that there's four drill sergeants in the window watching me.
Mm-hmm.
But then he went to do, you know, because we had the bayonet train. I knew exactly what he went to do. He was trying to do a, you know, a cross rifle butt stroke,
mm-hmm.
and I blocked it, and I hit him and knocked him down, knocked him out, and by that time the guys grabbed me and, you know, into the, you know, dining room I went into chow. So he said, what the hell, you crazy, man? So I said, well, screw it, man, I didn't do nothing wrong. He said, yeah, I know, but you only got 3 days left and all that. Well, it wasn't 5 minutes, and here comes Staff Sergeant Cass, K-A-S-T, that was our drill sergeant, and he came in there. Well, I mean, he's so loud. Yes, drill sergeant, you get your ass out here, and he's screaming and yelling at me, and took me right into that building, boy. And in that building, they had five drill sergeants and put me in the center.
Wow.
And then they just started, man, asking me every question, and was these big, back and forth, and left and right, left face, right face, south face, left face, right face, left face, you know. Oh, God, I figured, you know, they're going to beat the shit out of me. I'm not going to graduate. I want to get recycled, the whole thing, you know. Then when I left, I walked around the corner, and the drill sergeant said, what happened? Because I was trying to tell them what happened, but, you know, they wouldn't give me the opportunity. They knew what happened. They seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So I told them, he said, good, good. I'm glad you knocked the shit out of him. You did good. Get out of here. So I'm saying, like, Jesus
yeah.
Christ, you know. But he now he knows that I had passed the test. I did the ultimate test that in front of everybody, you know, I took, you know, he knew I was telling the honest to God truth,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
I did not touch his poncho.
Right.
Although I did cut into the corner of his formation. Mm-hmm. And him being he was a few weeks behind us, he did what he was supposed to do, come with pulled arms and halt, and so. But apparently I knocked his tooth out or something because they were really a little bit concerned about. So, I'll tell you what, we had a wee 5 days left. My punishment was, And since my buddy was with me that pulled me off, Moncrief, we had to do the inverted crawl, which is crawling on your hands and feet mm-hmm. backwards
mm-hmm.
For 100 yards before we ate every day.
Yeah.
To crawl the chow to get our food.
Wow. That's tough. Joey, what do you think you were the best at in basic? I mean, how did you distinguish yourself?
I don't know. It was, you know, I liked it. I loved it. I just liked the, and, you know, being off the street and being, what would you say, hating authority, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I fought authority and authority won. I guess that's just what I needed, you know. I just ate it up, you know. Kill, kill, kill. That was me, you know. Let's mm-hmm. go. When we went to the jump school test, you know, our company, we did all the events, and when we took off running, I was gone. I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just a rabbit to chase, you know. Mm-hmm. I came through there in like about, it was 2 miles in like, no, it was a mile and something like less than 6 minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was in boots and all, you know. I was just ready. You know, I just wanted to, you know, do it. And, you know, I had a girlfriend, and they gave me one day, I remember, and, you know, it wasn't no big thing, so I wasn't losing nothing. And the family was, you know, I just wanted to go to jump school. And, which we did, mm-hmm. As soon as you, you know, leave there, you get trucked over to, shipped down to jump school.
Mm-hmm.
And then, then you can tell who's been through the hard basic training.
Right, right. Cause
okay.
They can stick it out.
Oh, boy. Oh, man. It was, cause by the time I got there, it was, May. And it was hot, and every hour you'd have to, you get in the push-up position, and you do like a roller coaster to cool you down, and they run you to death. But they weren't in a way abusive in that way of saying you can't.
Mm-hmm.
They said you must.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It sort of gave them a better psychological training. If you can do it, you got to do it, you got to do it. You want to be airborne and all that. Well, I had made it through the first week, and I couldn't breathe.
Now, this is at jump school?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to Fort Dix for a minute. You said you made squad leader. How do you do that in basic? What happened?
Well, the way I did it as a drill sergeant, as I was going through and, you know, checking the guys' rosters and, you know, getting their names and all, I'd look for someone who I felt that was, slender, mm-hmm. athletic. I might ask him, you know, high school, playing football, do you do this? But I looked for someone who graduated high school and was athletic.
Okay.
And that's what I would go for.
Okay.
I wouldn't go for the biggest guy or anything like that. Because in the Rangers, believe it or not, the average weight, size and weight of a Ranger is like 5'10", 165 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 160 pounds. They made, not always, but that, the percentage was high school graduate that was athletic would usually, you could, I used the formula MDA. If they're motivated and they got discipline and they're aggressive,
mm-hmm.
I don't care how stupid, or I shouldn't say that, how slow or how weak they are,
mm-hmm.
I can make them stronger and I can make them smarter. If they have that magic drug, I used to say, MDA, motivation, discipline, and aggressiveness.
Mm-hmm.
If you stick with me and you listen to me, and I'll train you, and I'll make you stronger, and I'll make you smarter.
You obviously had this yourself.
Well, I don't know. I didn't think I had any discipline at all until you know, I got off that damn truck, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, them drill sergeants were in my face, you know, like, come on, hit me, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, but it was good training. But mm-hmm. I really felt that, you know, some of it wasn't needed. Now, that didn't mm-hmm. go on forever.
The basic.
Yeah, you know, touching his toes.
Right.
Because once we got so good that we could outmarch anybody, mm-hmm. we would, you know. So there was different ways that he used that. And there wasn't another thing.
Mm-hmm.
If, like I got in a fight, well, I got in a couple, everybody got in a fight. If we're in a chow line, we're out in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And two guys start fighting, the drill sergeants will turn away. And they'll let you fight it out. Where in the new army, they won't let you do that.
Right.
Where I believe in that.
So that was, why was that good? Why did that help?
Well, because if these guys are going to live together, okay, it's just like being in a high school football team, you know? I mean, you know, you're going to have arguments. Get it out of their system and mm-hmm. get it on with it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a drill sergeant, we started boxing every Sunday, myself and another E5
mm-hmm.
Who had some experience. We'd bring our platoons together, and we put 12-ounce gloves on them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and weighed them up as best we could and just let them beat the heck out of each other, okay?
Right.
So we get called down the orderly room. What the hell are you doing? I said, what do you mean? You're having them fighting out there. I said, Jesus Christ, we're teaching these freaking guys to kill, and they can't have fights? They've mm-hmm. got to get off of this team, mm-hmm. and they've got to realize that you're teaching them hand-to-hand combat, all right? I said, you know, it's good for them. They blow off the steam, and if they got something to do, they're pissed off with somebody, we let them beat the shit out of each other, and they get out of the system,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't interfere. I had two guys on police call. One big black guy and one big mountain white guy.
What's police call?
That's when you pick up the area.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Now, the evening before when they turned in their weapons, these guys have been kicking at each other for weeks when I was a drill. They almost went at it in the weapons room. So my partner tells me about it. I said, yeah, I know. Okay. So they were out on the highway, along the edge of the highway, and doing police call,
mm-hmm.
and they started slamming each other. So a drill sergeant goes down and breaks them up, and they bring them down, and my first sergeant wants to give them an Article 15. I said, hell no. What do you mean? I said, Top, they're here to kill. All they're doing is fighting. Jesus Christ, let me handle it. So I moved them in. I said, all right, these two guys, you are asshole buddies. You will go every single place. When one roster number call, you will go with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You will live together. You will shower together. The only time you can be apart is when one of you go on sick call or church. Otherwise, one man moves, the other man moves.
Wow.
And I did that for, they must have been for about 8 weeks. They were what we called asshole buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go out to a committee group and they'll say, that's number 58. And, boops, these guys pull up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't call for you. I'm the asshole buddies. And they, you know, and I'll tell you what, they became the best of friends.
That worked.
And it worked. And, you know, I was going for a physical to go somewhere years later, and when I walked in, this warrant officer, black guy, stood up at the detention and said, good afternoon, Sergeant Welch. And I said, who are you? And he said, you don't remember me? I was so-and-so, and he was the black guy who was fighting the white guy, and now he was a W-2 pilot.
Wow.
And he still was standing at the parade rest when I stood up, when I walked in. You know, I was an E6, E7 by then. I said, whoa, whoa, take it easy, G.
Yeah.
And I said, how you doing? He said, I said, have you heard from me? He says, yeah, we keep in touch. He's out there at, somewhere in the infantry, you know. And I said, well, what you do? He said, well, I passed the flight test and, you know, I'm flying choppers, you know. And he was all, you know, like, I really appreciate everything you've done and all, and how you doing? And I said, I'm all right. I'm, you know, but Christ, I said, God, you know. And then I didn't realize that these guys had to be 6'4", 6'5", you know. And that, to me, that's what we had to do. And what happened was, am I getting off the track?
Well, it's okay. I mean, this is exactly what we want to talk about. I mean, do you want to say anything else about your basic at 4-6?
Well, I'm comparing. See, in our basic training, well, I'll lead right into this because it will work out better.
Okay.
In our basic training, if you were out in the field and you guys started fighting, the drills would, you know, basically turn away. Now, they keep an eye to watch how far you go, but they'd let you go at it. And then they come over and yell and scream and break it up, but they'd let you go at it. They'd let you get it out of your system.
Right.
You know, I mean, Christ, you know, you're learning how to kill. And then when you went to jump school, okay, every Friday night, they had everyone, the first 2 weeks in jump school, you're totally restricted. All right? Now, I went through the first week, and what happened was, I woke up Saturday, I couldn't move, I couldn't breathe. I had upper respiratory infection due to the heat and the water that you had to go through. And, I was so, God, no, what's going to happen? But since I had passed all my performance evaluations and I was, you know, a hard charger, they told me that I would be on light duty for that week and then I would pick up. So I was a week behind. But what happened was, a friend of mine who I always got in all the trouble with me, what happened was, he was from my home, from my same high school. But we didn't know about it until we went in the Army the same day. And we didn't even know about it, and we spent basic together, but he got held up. And so what happened was, he winded up coming, like me, I was a week ahead of him, he winded up coming in, so he would be starting the first week, you know, when I was sitting it out. So I said, come on with me. And he was a boxer. See, I was more into martial arts. If he messed with me, I'd just start kicking him and he'd leave me alone. But he was a puncher. So I said, come on with me. And he said, where are you going? I said, come on, you're going to fight. And he said, what do you mean I'm going to fight? I said, you're going to fight. Every Friday night we got to fight. And they had a boxing ring outside. So I knew it at, I think it was 6 to 8, they practiced every night. So I went over and I said, excuse me, you know, whatever we call them, sergeants, because they weren't in the airborne committee at that time or whatever. Anyway, and I said, my buddy here can fight. You know, he can box good. Oh, he can. How much you weigh? All right. He said, get up here. Put his gloves on, Welsh. So I put his gloves on there, and he said, I'm crazy. I said, no, just slam the shit out of these guys. They can't fight, man. Just, I said, just knock the shit out of them, you know? Just tear in them. And I said, he's going to be bigger than him, but just tear in them. I said, just knock the shit out of him. Just think like you always do. And that's what he did, man. He went in there, and he weighed about 160, and they put a guy about 175, 180, you know, and came strolling out there, and Jimmy just went in there and started slamming. He knocked that sucker all over, and he said, all right, okay, you're in, you know. That was it. And so, you know, every night they would train. You train all day, then you'd eat, and then you'd go train 2 hours of box. And every Friday night, every man that wasn't allowed to go anywhere was at the, you know, the fight. And so they encouraged that. It was competitive, you know. And I carried that over with me to when I was a drill sergeant. And we got, you know, yelled at. But then this Italian XO came in, and he was a boxing fanatic. And the black guy that I was training with, he was 3-time European middleweight army champion.
Okay.
So he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
So this new Battalion XO said, I want a boxing team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute now. We're in infantry training, and we're living out there in the woods 2 or 3 weeks, you know. And he said, I want, you know, a boxing team.
Mm-hmm.
So me and John got together and said, okay, who can box? Raise your hand. All right, get on the truck. And we took him in there, and we just, you know, process elimination, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We found out real quick who could fight. But they had, I knew how they felt. And I knew, and John knew, that they'd give anything to punch the shit out of anybody. But we did not. I never touched the training. Never had to. I mean, I might grab him and drag him along.
Right.
But you don't have to. The guys who were pricks and the guys who were always yelling, they didn't do nothing. They couldn't do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And half of them couldn't do the PT. And it was just a makeup, you know, where they looked for a guy who would lead the way, who would do it first and show them that it can be done. Like
mm-hmm.
me, I'd go up the confidence course first, and then mm-hmm. I'd come down, I'd say, hey, I can do it, you can do it. That's where I tried to lead by example.
Right.
So,
Joey, tell me when you get to Benning. Are you feeling, you're obviously feeling confident about yourself, but are you feeling, what are you prepared for? What's going to be happening?
Oh, jump school?
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about what you go through. What's your day like there?
Okay, you're up and you are, this is the old jump school. You mm-hmm. were inspected from head to toe, and I mean, every crease, everything had to be perfect, or mm-hmm. you got so many demerits. And then you shuffled, I would say, across the field into the PT area.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would do your exhausting PT, and then run. And then you would start on, and you know, they had to train you and show you first. You'd start on one apparatus, and you'd, the first thing you would have to show you how to stand in the door. They'd take you right from the beginning, so you'd have to stand in the door and then jump in the door and the commands, and then how to land, and they'd start you by, you know, jumping off a little platform to all the... So that then they put you on this like 10-foot-high swing land training, and you're swinging back and forth, and they got you by the rope, and you don't know when they're going to drop you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all ground week. Okay, mm-hmm. And ground week sort of conditions you and weeds out the guys who are not in condition, and or who do not have the discipline. They just don't have it. I mean, you either had it or you didn't have it.
There right.
There was no, I didn't feel abused at all in jump school
mm-hmm.
compared to basic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was definitely pushed to the max, you know, but I was, you know, it was a challenge. But then I got sick and I was worried. But since I met the challenge, where in some cases they might have let another guy go, they let me stay on light duty for a week. So then I just met up with the next class.
Mm-hmm.
And the second week is tower week, where you jump out of the 34-foot towers. They mm-hmm. show you how to exit it. And then you go up on the 250-foot tower, and they drop you out. Every morning, though, you do have your, hardest inspection that you can find. Everything has got to be perfectly straight and spit shined. Only to go and crawl around in the sawdust
mm-hmm.
and run. But when you come home, you are soaking, muddy, wet, and exhausted. But at night, there wasn't any activity. They didn't mess with you. You couldn't go nowhere. So I usually went up to the boxing ring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only reason I didn't box was because I got sick. And because I would have fought that weekend, but then I just, once I got Moncrief up there, the guy said, okay, he'll be your replacement, Wells, because he knew I was sick,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that I was a good soldier. That's what they know. They know, you know, when you have a good soldier,
mm-hmm.
or someone who has the potential to be a good soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And why? He's motivated, he's disciplined, and he's aggressive.
How do you tell? I mean, you can see the motivation, you see the discipline, I guess. And what is the aggressiveness? Leading, getting out in front, or taking chances?
Not being told what to do. Not mm-hmm. not just doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Being the first up out of bed and having the bed made when, you know, the guy turns on the lights. Like me, I never slept under the covers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that guy, you know, turned on them lights, my bed was made. I was ready, you know, being ahead of everyone,
mm-hmm.
Anticipating what was going to happen. You knew what was going to happen. Now, God damn it, he shouldn't be, and he's going to scream at you all day if you don't. So just stay ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I felt. This way, the attention is taken away from you and mm-hmm. put towards someone who isn't quite as on the ball. And so what happens?
Mm-hmm.
You get, you know, less harassed and you learn faster. I was just a quick learner. I said, it's real simple. If I get up early and I get in there and shave before everybody, okay, I'm going to be done before everybody. I gave up sleep, but it didn't matter. I would be first. And as far as spit shine and boots and all that, you know, I got very few demerits. I never dropped out of a run. You know, I was just totally, totally gung-ho,
mm-hmm.
you know, totally mm-hmm. gung-ho. And they could see that, they knew that I was sick. And looking back on it now, they knew that, because I had to stay in bed for like 3 or 4 days. And then when I brought that kid up, it showed that, you know, I was like saying, hey, I can't do it, but my buddy's going to take my place. But I wasn't saying that. I was just making Jimmy fight, you know, I just
right.
went into play.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, okay, well, she'll take your place since you're sick,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, it was all right. You know, I went through the second week, and, you know, no problem. And the jumps, first jump, yeah, it wasn't nothing. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't even remember being scared because I didn't know what to expect. And they try to jump you 2 times Monday, 2 times Tuesday, and 1 Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Due to weather and aircraft, they want to try to get it done. Well, the first jump, you know what to expect. So, and you're so geared when you put your hand and they slap you on the ass, you jump. Well, then, oof, you know, then the second jump, you're like, holy shit, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like fourth man from the door, and I remember the guy went out, and I heard boom, 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 boom. He was hitting the side of the plane, you know.
Oh, God.
So, yeah. But then, you know, then you just go. You just go for it, you know. And then it's such a tremendous, not like today. I mean, this was only the best what made it into that plane,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many we started with. I have no idea, but I know there was about 155 or 156 on the plane manifest, so that's how many lasted.
How long would it be before you actually got up on the plane to jump?
You had, they only train Monday through Friday, so you train ground week Monday through Friday, then Saturday and Sunday, then Tower Week, Monday through Friday, so that's 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then Monday morning, you make your first jump. Monday afternoon, your second jump. Tuesday morning, third. Tuesday afternoon is your fourth and that's your full equipment with this bag that's bigger than me, and you can't move, you fall out the plane, you double, you know, but that's the big equipment jump. And then the fifth jump would be on a Wednesday morning, and when all you had to do was get out the aircraft. Well, I've seen guys with blown up legs, you know, that were hurting bad, but all you had to do was get out the aircraft on the fifth jump, and you got your wings. And then they came along and they pinned them on. That's when they used to slap them on and you chat, you know, thud wings. And man, you felt like you were 10 feet tall, you know, and it was good. It was good training. And then that was Wednesday. So Thursday morning, Wednesday afternoon, they would tell you where your assignment was because they already made the assignments, figuring. Not a lose a percentage, but and so you go up, you get your wings sewed on and your patch, and you know you're Billy Badass. Now you're walking around, and then the next day they say you're all levied and you're going to Germany with no leave, and you know everyone Friday morning, the whole class, and 80% of them were headed for Vietnam. And so,
geez, that's a really quick turnaround.
I mean,
That's a lot of. I mean, what do you think you were best at jump school? What did you excel at when you look back at it?
I guess, like I said, the discipline and the motivation. I was so motivated that, like I said, I was a quick learner. By then, after being through the basic I went through, I learned the routine real quick. Okay, if like I said, if I'm up before these guys and I'm done shaving and my stuff's ready, I'm going to be ready. And the faster I'm ready, the less I'll be messed with and the more the other guy will be messed with. And plus, I don't know, I just had a knack. I was always a sharp, you know, not a, yeah, I guess a sharp dresser as a kid. Even, you know, that's just the way we grew up in South Philly and stuff like that, you know. So having to dress neat and polish boots and all that, to me, was nothing. I'd sit up for hours at night and polish the boots and all that kind of stuff. And I'd be meticulous, you know. My father brought me up that way. That's why my name's Brasso. Because my bike was always the shiniest, and you know, I kept myself. My father put in me that if you keep it maintained, then it lasts longer. You know, that went for everything. You know, I went for your damn, you know, your shirt, your car, your bicycle. It didn't matter. And my father was very, very meticulous. So, and I'm kind of, my wife says anal about it, you know. I mean, if you came into my house, you wouldn't believe, you know, that everything has got to be dress right, dress, cover down, you know, everything's got to be just right. There is no room for something being out of place. Where you go, when I was a bachelor, it was the same way. I was a bachelor for over 10 years. I mean, girls would come to my house and say, God, my God, your house is, you know, it's cleaner than mine. And I'd say, well, you know, it's the way you're supposed to be. You know, when you open my closet, everything was dressed right, dressed, you know. And you know, and then when I got to the 09, that was the way that place was run. Dress right, dress, cover down, 40 inches all around, you know, or get on down, beat your face on the sidewalk, son. It was very, 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 you had to be there 6 months to earn a 3-day pass, and that's in a regular unit. And you, how you earned it? By soldiering, okay? And we went up to guard mount, and we would have the one guy carry your weapon, one guy carry your pistol belt, and you'd walk stiff armed, and they would place you in the formation, and you would go against, you know, they'd ask you questions. and whoever answered and looked the sharpest and answered the most became the colonel's orderly.
Right.
And he did not stand guard. He was on standby, and he would go with the NCOIC, and he would take down the flag, and the whole time Sergeant Major's on top watching you,
mm-hmm.
and then raise the flag in the morning, and then he would report to the Sergeant Major. Now, this Sergeant Major was my idol. I mean, to me, he was, I don't know if you ever heard the expression when E.F. Hutton speaks, well,
mm-hmm.
you know, when he spoke, E.F. Hutton listened.
Mm-hmm.
This guy had been in World War II, Korea, Vietnam. He had 3 CIBs, 5 combat jumps, and he was harder than woodpecker lips.
No, what was his name? What is his name?
I can't remember.
Okay.
It's total blank. But you would go and you would spend the day with him,
mm-hmm.
okay, if you made colonel's orderly. And then he would ask you, when do you want your 24-hour pass?
Mm-hmm.
And you could name, you could have the biggest inspection known to the unit.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick that day, you could lay in that bed, and you put you. All you do is hold up that piece of paper. Of course, you pick a Saturday, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and I had a friend of mine. We were very competitive, and I had a friend of mine, Chochutsa now, who was a Mongolian from Philadelphia. He made it like 11 times straight. He had the record in the entire brigade, and I was there 90 days. I volunteered for Vietnam, and 4 months later, I went home on leave, and then went to Vietnam. Then I found out he got to Vietnam, and he got wounded, and he came over, found out where I was, and what happened was a guy came out of a spider hole and got a round off before he did, but it hit the M16, blew up the M16, and put a couple holes in his stomach. And so we hung out a couple of days, and then this other wild man I was with, Dutchie,
mm-hmm.
I told Dutchie, he said, where are you going? You going to stay with Lurps? I said, no, I'm getting the hell out of here, man. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, the division's coming. You know, they were in, this was December of 67. I said, you know, they're all playing war heroes down in Saigon during Tet, you know. I said, I'm going up to E Company 20th Lurps with Johnny Strohmeyer and them. And he said, well, I'm going to do one more tour and I'll meet you up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, have you seen Chochutsa now? And he looked at me, and that look, and he said, you didn't hear? And I said, no. He said, yeah, he got killed on Christmas Eve.
Mm.
And, you know, we talked a little bit, and Dutchie winded up, actually, I went over to Lurps, and Dutchie winded up coming in after me, and these other guys, that, you know, but this guy... We tried to get him, we went and told the first sergeant as a platoon, we went and told the first sergeant that Chochutsa now, he didn't make corporal, I made spec 4.
Now this is over in Vietnam.
No, this is Germany.
Okay, this
Before
is in
we
Germany.
Went to Vietnam, we all went to our platoon sergeant and said that Chochutsa now should be promoted to a hard corporal for his reward of, you know, making it 11 times. And the brigade, he's made it more than anyone in the brigade. Nobody could beat him, you know. And we went down to the first sergeant as a platoon, and he threw us out.
Really?
Yeah, he threw us out. Wow, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he threw us out. He was a smire. I'll never forget him because I was in country about 6 months, and... I was riding shotgun to go pick up new troops, and who jumps off the truck?
Mm-hmm.
First sergeant from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yo, what's up? No first sergeant or nothing, you know. I was a wise-ass, you know, been in country, you know, 7-8 months. Oh, how you doing, Wells? Outstanding. How about you, Top? And he shook my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Things were different now, you know. But,
well, tell me a little bit about... finishing up jump school and then heading off to Germany.
I finish up, well, like I said, finish up jump school, and usually if you was going to go anywhere else, you would have went home on a 2-week leave at least, and then go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, DA decided that they needed paratroopers, so we were the ones they picked. We just graduated on Wednesday, changed our orders on Thursday, put us on the plane on Friday, and we went to a replacement detachment over there. I was there 3 or 4 days, and then we went to the 509.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was airborne infantry mechanized. Mm-hmm. And it was one brigade with 2 battalions. I was in headquarters, 1st Battalion and Recon Platoon, and all we did was train.
What year was this, Joey?
I arrived there in the end, I graduated July 66, beginning of August.
Okay.
66.
Okay.
And then I wasn't there but 2 weeks, and then we went somewhere in Germany. I don't know, but I know it was freezing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's then you go and make your cherry jump, your first jump with a unit.
Mm-hmm.
This is when they used to jump in the V formation with a lead plane and one on each side.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually they stopped that because some of the guys in the lead planes were getting hit by the planes behind them.
That's not a good
but,
thing.
you know, you're used to get ready, stand up, all that. Well, they really, really, really bust them for you, man. I mean, when they opened the door, that's the last thing I remember. I was just trying to hook up my stuff. They had me sandwiched, and this guy had pushing in my face. He had nylon. Mm-hmm. It's really a piece of parachute he brought with him. And he's going, "Hey, shit's pouring out over here." And I'm like, wait. I mean, didn't even touch my feet, didn't even touch the floor. I mean, and then the back, and they would actually get up on the seats and start jumping up and down and mm-hmm. screaming, "God's a punk if we don't have 2 streamers in here." And we had a one-eyed guy named Johnson. He was an E-4 with 14 years in. And then a PFC Evans with about 8 years in. And they would push the stick. And that meant when the green light went go, they would just run. They would be behind you and just push you. There was no separation. There was no touching the door. I was just sandwiched between 2 guys, thinking that my parachute was coming out of my pack and all this shit, when it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they broke your cherry, you know. And then we would have races. The one plane against the other plane.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonel was involved in all this.
Mm-hmm.
He set it up. All right, we're going to have a race today. The 2 trails will be, and blah, 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 blah. And they'd say go, and the last ones to be unloaded would have to buy the beer that
mm-hmm.
night.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, because of the weather, first of all, there was no drop zone. There were no drop zones. You jumped. I've seen guys. We jumped in wine vineyards, and guys went impaled on wine vineyards. I've seen another guy streamer in. That's the first time I seen somebody shoot in on him, and he hit, and his thigh bones come out of his chest. And
jeez.
And yeah, we just started saying gory. What the hell was I in? We ain't going to jump no more.
This is what you would sing this.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was just, they would take us out and they'd jump us in the middle of a town. Like guys were landing on barn roofs and all kind of stuff. Because, you know, then they'd say, "All right, get on the truck." Well, there wasn't no truck. It was a truck to put your parachute on. And then you'd walk back 18 miles. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole brigade would be jumping. So there'd be hundreds of guys in the air and hundreds of guys on the ground, and we were walking. We had just started walking up alongside, and this guy come out, and just, it's called a streamer, you know, mm-hmm. he ain't got it. And you could hear the bellowing. Every man in the air and on the ground is yelling, pull your reserve, pull your reserve. Well, if you hear that, everybody looks up. But this guy didn't. He just stayed folded, closed. And he just streamered in. You could hear him screaming. We were yelling, pull your reserve. And boom, he bounced in. And that's what he did. He bounced. And one of the old timers picked up Gory, Gory, and that's got about 20 phases. We sang that for about 8 miles, I was in the headquarters company, and which headquarters contains the administrative, commo, supply, recon, and medic.
Mm-hmm.
And my guys were on medic drop zone duty, and they said they picked that son. They said, we picked that guy up. His thigh bones come out his chest. He said he was about four foot. They just laughed too, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have to do jumps out of choppers sometimes because of the weather and all. And man, it would be non-jumpable time. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, it was a little bit too windy to jump. But we had to get the jumps in, so, you know, you just knew when you hit the ground, pull that damn thing and release. And I'll never forget, the colonel was, and it was muddy all the time over there, the colonel was just being drugged. And everybody tries to knock everybody down, you know. But we were out there, and I think it was only like the guys that were really hurting for jumps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had the pay hurts. You had to jump once every 90 days, minimum.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been maybe 50 or so of us, I don't know. But I remember the colonel coming, and he had one white clean strip about eye to eye down the front and back, you know. And we were laughing like hell. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll give you something to laugh about. Come on around here. And he opened the back of his truck, three-quarter ton, and he had must have been about 5 cases of beer on ice.
Wow.
And he said, let's drink. You know,
mm-hmm.
We jumped, let's drink. Yeah, and it was great.
It sounds like a good guy.
Oh, the camaraderie. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we would start our run, and we'd run around posts for maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes to get warmed up. And mm-hmm. then we'd run maybe anywhere from 5 to 8 miles through mm-hmm. the town. Well, of course, I had only been over there a while, and we would stop and we would be running in place for trains and shit.
Mm-hmm.
And the people hated us. The people hated us. They called us the Mind's Little Zoo, because I remember when the colonel called us all together, which was very rare, but he had the whole brigade there, and he read a letter from the political committee of mine
mm-hmm.
to the President of the United States. This is serious. No, mm-hmm. this is true. Mm-hmm. I swear. It said that they request that the animals from Mike's Little Zoo be removed because they are terrorizing their families and what children and stuff like that. Of course, guys were jumping the fence every night, and, you know, because they couldn't get a pass, and we were just crazy, and fight, oh, my God, you know, as soon as you got off post, you know, paratroopers were just geared to fight, you know,
mm-hmm.
and, I mean, they would show you, in them days, they had, it looked like, you know, it's called an overseas cap. You know, the little thin one.
Mm-hmm.
But they would block it like Beetle Bailey. All right? It was mm-hmm. blocked like that. And then the glider patch would be on the left side if you was an enlisted. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And they show you how to sew in a silver dollar in there and fold it so that you could use it as a weapon. And then when you put it on, it's actually blocked. It wasn't on there straight. It was blocked just like Beetle Bailey, and we called it a cunt cap. mm-hmm. because of the way it opened and all,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then they'd show you that the rope, the French fourgé on your rope, how you could rip that off and use that as a weapon. And, you know, it was just tremendous training, constant training. They would take you out and you would load up every piece of equipment and every ration you have. You'd drive 10 miles and you might sit for 2 hours and say, okay, let's go back. Or you might get on an airplane and you might jump out somewhere and go on a 2-week mission. Mm-hmm. You never knew what was going to happen because that was Cold War days, you know?
Yeah.
So we were the strike battalion,
mm-hmm.
actually. We were the only, well, there were some LERPs, small unit LERPs in Germany, 7th Corps LERPs, but we were the major strike force for Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So we were constantly, you know, being called out. But it was good training. And you, airborne infantry mechanized is unheard of. I mean, what the hell are you going to do with tracks, okay? So since we were in the recon and the headquarters, we would always be the op 4,
mm-hmm.
all right? And so, you know, it's real hard to detect, but we would set up on, you know, this ground and this area, and then we'd have out a lookout, and then we'd have the rest of the platoon back. And, of course, you could hear the track coming, you know, and you could hear them get out. And then they'd take about 10 steps, and, boy, we had trip flares and all the shit. So, of course, they'd get online and charge, and you'd start firing them up. And then they'd chase you, and then you'd run right through your people, and then they'd run right into our ambush. And we beat every company in the
mm-hmm.
in the battalion. In every platoon, nobody could beat us because we had the trainers. We had a guy from Korea. We had a black guy that was great. He made corporal, he made E5 twice over there in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he'd get busted down, and then he'd make corporal sergeant, and they'd bust him down again, but he was such a good infantryman. You know, he taught us so much that, like, we didn't care if they sent a company. We'd always get them, you know?
Yeah.
Even if they came on foot, he just taught us so much about, and it was small unit tactics that he was teaching us because we were the small unit out for. And it helped a lot.
Yeah. Were you all thinking that you were definitely going to go to Vietnam, or was that, did you all want to go? What was the attitude and the mood surrounding Vietnam when you were in Germany?
Well, we didn't have that many returnees at mm-hmm. first,
mm-hmm.
Except for higher ranking. And see, there was in Marines, there's very, very strict class structure.
Mm-hmm.
There's enlisted, NCO, and then officers.
Mm-hmm.
In the Army, it's enlisted and officers. In special ops, it's special ops. We were in Cherry Point, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
in the Marine Corps, in the Naval Air Station, and we were standing in line. There was a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, an E-8, and myself, who was an E-7, another E-7. And the steward came out and said, excuse me, sir, but the officers eat over there. And he said, no, I eat with my men.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant major was there, too. And the sergeant major says, yeah, we where the fuck we want. That's where he told him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. We waited in line. He said, you don't have to wait in line. You know, you can go over there. And we were all E-7s and above, you know. I said, no, we'll wait in line. And, you know, the guys around, the Marines, are looking at us like, hey, you know. But the colonel put it to him nicely, but Sergeant Major said, we'll eat where the fuck we want.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, we'll go in there and eat in the goddamn officer's place if you don't shut the hell up. So mm-hmm. that special ops was very, very close on a first-name basis.
Why were you all so close? What makes it so different for, I'm talking about the people listening to this years from now. How can you make them understand
because,
that?
Because you go, that's why the Marines are probably, over, pound for pound, the best trained and disciplined service,
mm-hmm.
because it's small. It's very small.
Mm-hmm.
What do they got, 3 divisions? You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
4 divisions?
Yeah.
Well, we got 10, 11, 12. And when you get in the special operations community, very rarely will anyone ever leave it. So you become very familiar with your teammates.
Mm-hmm.
You have got to rely on that teammate. He has got to rely on you. And when a team leader shows up, who's a brand new captain, he could get to SF. Now, in the old days, they got to go through the same training as the enlisted. But when they get to SF, usually a good colonel will say, "Captain, I want you to pay attention to your team sergeant,"
mm-hmm.
and maybe he'll mention someone else on the team that he knows, "for the first couple of months until you get settled in."
Mm-hmm.
Don't go in there trying to bust down no doors,
mm-hmm.
okay? Just do it that way, and I think you'll be a lot better off. Some of them would tell them that. Of course, it'd be real simple. It's the same way when I was in the infantry. If I got some lieutenant in and he started yelling and screaming and hollering, I'd say, "Hey, sir, can we talk?" Platoon sergeant, I'd say, "Look, we have an EDRE, which is an emergency deployment,
mm-hmm.
Exercise, coming up, and we're graded in that. We're graded in that, at the battalion level. Now, my platoon took first place last time. But you know what? They could stumble, they could fumble, they could screw up. Anything could happen in situations like this. And they could wind up coming in last."
Mm-hmm.
And they'd look at me like, "Oh, this is blackmail." I said, "No, sir, this is the fucking Army. And you've been nowhere, done nothing. And I run this fucking platoon. And either you want to win, then you let me lead. And you take care of the troops until you got your feet on the ground, or they will lose for me."
Mm-hmm.
They will lose. And that's just what I tell them. In SF, you went about it a little bit different, because you was a senior NCO.
Mm-hmm.
The slots are 1E8, 8, 7E7, a warrant officer, and a captain.
Mm-hmm.
I basically tell them, "Hey, sir, you know, if that's where you're going to be, fine. Just remember, you're the one that issues that sign for the ammo."
Mm-hmm.
I tell them just like that. In other words, if you sign for the ammo, and that means if we get into close quarter battle training or any kind of rifle thing, you just might die.
Right.
And that was basically it. And they're only going to spend 18 months. Remember that.
Mm-hmm.
An officer is only going to spend 18 months to 2 years and punch his ticket and he's on his way.
Mm-hmm.
That E6, E7 is going to be there for 18 years. Okay?
That's a hell of a difference.
Yeah. You're damn right. So, you either straighten them out or, you just don't perform for them.
Yeah.
And, and there's a lot of, "Let's take it out back, and we'll take it out back," and that's it,
mm-hmm.
And so you become very, very close. Now, we don't call I never called the officers by their first name,
mm-hmm.
except when we were alone and they said that.
Mm-hmm.
Joey, and plus you have a cover story. When we go to Philippines, we would not wear anything out of the ordinary, no patches or nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they know we're in the Army. So, they'd ask you what your assignment was. And my unit was the 10th ASG in Japan, and I was an Army photographer.
Right.
And that was my hobby, and I had to know that.
Mm-hmm.
I had to know that story. I had to know what I was talking about. Okay, that was our cover story, So
who made that up? Was that you, or was that kind of designated?
Well, they
by?
Sort of fit the profile of the person. Mm-hmm. A buddy of mine, he was a contracting engineer, mm-hmm. and that was his job. And he knew exactly, you know, how to present himself in the civilian sector mm-hmm. to make them believe that. Where I was at a disadvantage, I was tattooed up, mm-hmm. right? So I would usually say, if I was in Thailand, I would say I was retired from the Army,
right.
and now I'm a freelance photographer or whatever, you know? So you built your cover story that to fit your personality and, of course, your knowledge,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, of course, I did travel in plain clothes for a couple of years. I carried a weapon on and off aircraft, you know. So you had to have, the cover story down real good. And, they're known as the quiet professionals. And they occasionally will get out of hand, but we try to police ourselves. We don't want to be drawing any attention mm-hmm. or any international incidents.
Why would you, or where would you use the cover? When was this employed?
Downtown. Say we're going downtown. Say we're on a mission. And we finish up the mission in Thailand, and then we spend a couple weeks, and we go out to an island over downtown somewhere. We never could wear, fatigue. You would wear civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the Philippines, your clothes, the Philippines know. They know you're in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because most of the time in the Philippines, you can wear your uniform. In Thailand, you can't, not in any major city.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone would talk, well, I spoke Thai, too, so that mm-hmm. that made it a little bit easier. But, we would be out, and we'd be out on these islands, you know, and they'd be British girls, from all over the world that we would, converse with and hang out with. And, we got into some interesting things because they would, the Brits, they think that what they actually done, to try to colonize everybody, they actually think that we are trying to dominate the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
This is really their idea. And we went to dinner with two girls one night, and the girl I was with wasn't into politics, and I wasn't, but the girl, she darn sure was. Now, they thought for sure that we were civilians, over there, and it never even entered into their mind. I told them that I had spent, a few years in the Army, because I have one that says paratrooper. I can't get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was forgotten about. And this girl came right out and said, you go over to these countries and you take them over and you want to turn everybody into like this. And they went on and on and on. And I had an enjoyable evening laughing at them because I did have to mention to the girl, though, I said, isn't that sort of in your history of mm-hmm. what England did,
mm-hmm.
She said, all right, we don't have to get into that now. And I said, just laughing, and we had a great time, but I said, Jesus. And they went for the cover story. And then if the Marines came in, we were notified right away. The Marines are in, and they would say the fleet's in. So we would get out of the resort town.
Mm-hmm.
We would get out of the resort town and let the Marines take it over, because they would just go crazy. And you cannot afford to have what they call an international incident where you get involved in anything to do with a foreign national, because you're supposed to be in there undercover. Mm-hmm. And then I've seen guys, you know, getting a little bit of problems, and in 3 hours they were on a plane and gone before anybody even woke up.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the police would come around with, you know, tourism police, you know. We're looking for so-and-so and so. Well, I'm sorry, you know, he's not here, you know. We just became, when I was a freshman, I was with Okinawa. We were locked up on this island. We were locked up in an old NAS area on the beach, which was entirely fenced in. There was no windows in the building. It was a brick building. And so you become very close. And you do everything together, you know. And we didn't have any barracks, so most people had to live off post or in another. I stayed in the Air Force base. And the way, like, if the way they notified us, you know, they had Armed Forces Network. If there was, they needed us, they, you know, how they had run that neon, you know, the strip along the bottom of the TV. They would say something like, Private Johnson from the 432nd, you know, Air Wing, report to your unit, you know. And they might do that 3 or 4 times. That might be our keys, meaning, let's go. And then we'd all go, because there was no telephone communication. We would all get our stuff and go, you know, in.
Right.
You know, so you just become very close, and you're very competitive, but you also you stick together as a team, because you're going to count on each other. Because when you go into a country and you're training maybe 100 guerrillas, you tell them, okay, if the enemy comes and they overrun us, this is how you're going to escape, and you give an E&E plan. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you privately give your team an E&E plan in case the guerrillas decide to overtake you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was commonplace in Vietnam, where, you know, especially when you got Mountaineers and Vietnamese together, boy, that would really get mixed. So you would always make an E&E plan for you to get the hell out of Dodge, because, you know, you're in the middle. In our case, we'd be in the middle of Thailand, maybe 50 miles from the Burmese border, and you know, there's 100 of them and 10 of us, or maybe if we had a Thai team, it'd be 10, 20 of us. If they decided to coup went down and they decided to go with the other side, they could overrun us real quick. So we had our plan to escape from them, you know, which they didn't know about, you know. So you become very close, and, you know, they're not all superhuman. They're not all excellent soldiers. But the majority of them are very sincere and dedicated in what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Joey, let me ask you this. When
did it?
No. Let me ask one more question. When you received orders from Vietnam, when you were in Germany.
Well, I requested it.
You requested. Tell me why you requested.
Well, I felt I'm in the Army. I requested it after jump school. I felt that if I was going to be in the Army, I should be where the war is. It was just that simple. And that was it. I mean, why the hell am I freezing my ass off in Germany when, you know, I got to go. I got to go. I got to see, you know, how I'll do. I have to see how I'll do. And I have to go.
How'd your parents feel about that, your family?
Well, I'm sure that everyone at that point in time knew that their kid, if they went in, was definitely probably going to go.
Mm-hmm.
They knew when I went to Germany, and I told them that I was going to eventually go to Vietnam, and, you know, they, of course, my father, you know, being in the Second World War and all, you know, they supported me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came home, and they were all ecstatic, you know, that I was going home, and then we settled down, they said, where are you going to be stationed now? And I said I was going back to Vietnam. Well, mm-hmm. That caused a little bit of turmoil, you know.
Yeah, they're like,
and one... I never planned on leaving Vietnam.
Yeah.
I had never, I would probably still be there.
Wow.
Like I said, you had 179 days you could get out of the Army. Well, after my first tour, I went home for 30 days, and my records were supposed to be sent to LERP.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was done my 6 months, I extended for Special Forces, which we've been working with in Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back and said, well, you can't go. And I said, why? They said, well, you only got 150 days. You shouldn't even be in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, if I wanted to get out of the Army, I wouldn't be extending. So, you know, extend me 90 days to put me over the 180 days thing and send me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because I don't want to go anywhere but to, you know, over the 5th Group.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking us left and right because we had been working with them so much. And this is how, now, you have to understand, administratively, I had never been in trouble. I really didn't understand the system of administration. All I knew was how to soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But to this, I just thought about it the other night when I was telling a story to a guy. They said I was supposed to be out of the Army. And I said I didn't want to get out of the Army. I wanted to stay in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So just at that time, and they could have. But they said, well, normally, see, at a certain time, your records move up to the administration to move you,
mm-hmm.
I guess. But I didn't have any records, but they say it's too late. Your records are already cut. Your orders are already cut, and you're going to Fort Bragg. Now, I said, wait a minute, isn't this kind of contradicting? I'm supposed to be able to be out of the Army, and I want to stay in the Army, and you won't extend me 90 days, but you're going to send me back to Fort Bragg. By the time I get out of here, go home on leave, I'm going to have about 100 days,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'll just get out. And they said, no, you can't now. You got to go. So, you know, I winded up going home, and I went home for 30 days, and I went to the Pentagon or the personnel center up there, and I requested to go to drill sergeant in California now. So I requested to go to drill sergeant in Fort Dix because my mother needed me close to home because I had been deployed for almost 30 months. And so they put me on a 2-week extra leave, and the medical decision was no. And my mother did have a hysterectomy, and she was quite concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, you're going to Fort Bragg. So I didn't go. I went to Fort Dix and turned myself in.
Okay.
And the next day, and they put me, I was in class A's, C5, you know, put me in a cage, and I sat there overnight. They didn't say a word to me, treated me like a piece of shit. Punk-ass MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, some young E4 will come up, and as soon as he seen me, I looked at him, and I seen them wings on his chest. He walked right over, grabbed them keys, and then nobody said nothing. And he said, how you doing, Sergeant Airborne? I said, how you doing, whatever his name was. And he said, what the hell's going on? Come on over here, sit down. He was a clerk. And nobody said anything. He said, want some coffee? And nobody said nothing. He, you know, two paratroopers meeting. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him the honest God truth of what had happened. And he called up to the first sergeant in the 82nd. Now, they just know a name and a number is supposed to arrive. And the guy's screaming, yelling at me, saying, no, first sergeant, you do not have to send anybody up here, two guards, to get him. I'm telling you that DA, and I have it, it's all here in writing, the DA put him on 2 weeks leave waiting pending a medical board, and then he came here to try to get a hop. And he's going to be reporting to you. So he saved my ass, really.
Yeah.
And he said, guess what? See, I was trying to, I figured if I signed in there, they say, hey, man, the guy's got 100 days. Let's just even stay here, and he could work at replacement and help out.
Yeah.
But nope, he said, Sergeant Wells, we got to take you to the aircraft.
Right.
You know. Well,
Joey, I think this is a good stopping point.
Yeah. So I winded up at going to the 82nd with maybe 110 days left.
Okay. I'll tell you what, we'll pick up on Friday with talking about your trip over to Vietnam. Thanks.